Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement today by Attorney General Jeff Sessions that the Trump administration will withhold $4.1 billion in DOJ grants unless some 300 American communities can certify that they are not so-called sanctuary cities and counties. Ivan Espinoza Madrigal, the executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice in Boston, who is the first to sue the Trump administration on behalf of sanctuary communities, joins us. We will discuss how the issues of states' rights comes into play in this case when the federal government is trying to impose its will and muscle smaller communities that want to uphold the law for all citizens into adopting policies that will result in minority communities not cooperating with local police. Then we'll assess whether Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, is trying to sabotage inquiries into the Trump administration's alleged ties to Russia, or if he is just a dumb guy put in charge of overseeing intelligence. David Halperin, a former counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, joins us to discuss the desperate and clumsy attempt to give Trump cover with so-called intelligence that Nunes was given by the White House the day before he showed up there again to hand the target of an investigation evidence that Trump claims exonerates him. Then finally, we'll look into the extent to which Trump can sabotage Obamacare, which after the Trump-Ryan repeal and replace plan blew up, a chastened Paul Ryan reminded us is now the law of the land. An expert on health policies, James Marone, a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University and author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office, joins us to discuss whether Trump can make his claim that Obamacare will explode a reality. And joining us now is Ivan Espinoza Madrigal, who's executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice in Boston. He's a civil rights attorney who's suing the Trump administration on behalf of sanctuary communities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ivan Espinoza Madrigal.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you're the first out of the gate, Ivan, in terms of Jeff Sessions just made the announcement today that he was withholding funds from sanctuary cities. So tell me, give us a sense of what your lawsuit attempts to do.
We are the first lawsuit filed in the East Coast and the first lawsuit filed by a civil rights organization on behalf of blue-collar, low-income, heavily immigrant communities that have made decisions to deprioritize immigration enforcement because they want to make sure that people can come out of the shadow and trust local government and police. So we represent two cities in Massachusetts, Chelsea and Lawrence. Both of these communities rely on sanctuary policies to integrate all of the families and children in their jurisdictions to local services and protections.
And what is the methodology that Sessions plans to use to withhold money? Is it this, he's simply just going to go through the list of sanctuary cities and just basically cut off $4.1 billion in DOJ grants to these cities? Because my understanding is most of this money goes for law enforcement operations.
A large part of the money does go to law enforcement and fire protection, actually, but a significant component of the funding is really used to keep public schools open, to keep the doors open, to keep the lights on, and also to provide free and subsidized breakfast and lunch to low-income children in public schools. So these are life-saving programs that benefit everyone in a community, regardless of their immigration status. And you raise a really interesting point about how widespread these policies are. There are many different manifestations of what it means to be a sanctuary community. Some, for example, have manifested it through local ordinances, others through resolutions, others through local executive orders, and in many cases, no two look alike. So we have literally hundreds of these communities spread out across the country, and many of them have different manifestations of what sanctuary means. So it's really impossible to create a one size fits all or some type of silver bullet that is going to apply to all of the different communities. And the bottom line is that we should be having conversations about how to improve services for all of our residents, particularly immigrant communities, so that people come out of the shadow, not talking about destabilizing these communities and depriving them of life-saving money.
And for example, here in Los Angeles, the mayor does not refer to L.A. as a sanctuary city, even though it is, for all intents and purposes, a sanctuary city like San Francisco and other cities and the communities that you represent, Ivan Espinosa Madrigal. So does that get L.A. off the hook if you say you're not a sanctuary city when, in fact, you are?
Well, that's, again, an example of how different sanctuary communities look and feel across the country. Some are very flamboyant about their sanctuary or immigrant protections. Others are not. And still, there are, like I said, many different looks and feels for this. So in LA, like you just identified, they don't necessarily embrace the title sanctuary community or sanctuary city, but they still have programs that could be perceived as such. And so it really takes a very detailed analysis to be able to determine what are exactly the immigrant protections that apply on the ground. And for the federal government to do this undertaking, it's painstaking work, and it really is misplacing where the federal government should be prioritizing its efforts and its resources. We should be focusing on protecting families and children, not depriving them of resources that they need.
And again, I'm speaking with Ivan Espinosa Madrigal, the Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice in Boston, and a civil rights attorney who's suing the Trump administration on behalf of sanctuary communities. So is Attorney General Sessions using a very blunt instrument here in terms of holding back this $4.1 billion in funding? It seems as though he basically, in his announcement today, he made the charge that sanctuary cities and sanctuary communities are harboring felons. That is not my understanding.
Nothing could be further from the truth. The bottom line is that the communities that we represent, for example, in Massachusetts, the cities of Chelsea, the city of Lawrence, still collaborate with federal immigration officials and with every aspect of the federal government. They are in violation of not a single federal or state law. They have opted to deprioritize immigration so that they can better serve the needs of the constituents on the ground. That is their right under the Constitution, which very expressly demarcates the roles and responsibilities of the federal government versus the roles and responsibilities of local and state governments. This is an issue of federalism, an issue of the 10th Amendment. And so it is misplaced and frankly discriminatory to be targeting immigrant-heavy communities for defunding purposes when they are, in fact, complying with every aspect of federal and state law. And they are being used as a scapegoat. They are being used as an example of the anti-immigrant and xenophobic rhetoric that we have been hearing from the Trump administration.
So what is the legal basis then, Ivan Espinosa Madrigal, of the lawsuit that you just filed on behalf of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice against the Trump administration's move today by the Attorney General to go after sanctuary cities and communities?
So we filed our lawsuit rooted in basic principles of federalism, of the separation of powers. The federal government cannot force, compel, bully these small communities into doing its bidding, into doing immigration enforcement that belongs in the federal realm. there's a separation of powers for a reason. These things belong to the federal government, not at the local level. At the local level, we need to dedicate our resources to solving local police issues, to solving law enforcement problems that our constituents are facing, not for enforcing federal immigration law. So it's about the separation of spheres and powers. It is really rooted in that basic concept. And so we are asserting states' rights, local rights, and our right to be free of this type of federal coercion.
Well, of course, that has always been a conservative calling card, has it not? It's been states' rights is code for, you know, a lot of conservative ideas and policies, particularly when it comes to the racial issues, etc., in this country. So are you finding anybody on the conservative side of the political spectrum jumping aboard if you're taking essentially a conservative argument here?
We are taking what some people, as you just described, would be a more conservative approach, which is we are being innovative. I think in the civil rights movement, in the progressive movement, we haven't made these arguments rooted in states' rights, rooted in fiscal responsibility. And our lawsuit is integrating these innovative arguments because that's the bottom line. That's what's being affected here. What's being affected is federal encroachment of local powers. It is forcing local low-income communities to use their scarce resources to enforce federal immigration priorities. It's a fiscal issue. And so we are using these themes, these arguments in our lawsuit. And I think the bottom line is that with the unprecedented challenges that we face right now as a country, as an immigrant rights movement, we need to think outside of the box. And so that's exactly what we did here. We are presenting arguments that some would say are not traditional for the type of issues that we're talking about, but this is exactly what it boils down to. Unfortunately, we have not seen many folks on the more conservative spectrum jumping on board, as you asked. I think that some of that may come to pass, but for now, we are continuing to defend these hard-working cities to make sure that scarce taxpayer resources are being dedicated to local priorities and not to the compelled federal immigration work that Attorney General Jeff Sessions and that the Trump administration wants to impose on our communities. They need to leave us alone so that we can run our communities in the way we know best.
Well, what do your police chiefs and law enforcement officials say? Because here in Los Angeles, again, the chief of police is very, very clear, and he's made a lot of statements in this regard, that the police need the cooperation of these communities in order to get real criminals and to single them out. And if you allow the federales to come in and kick down doors, then the entire community, because they do have on their, you know, their flak jackets and their vests, etc., they have the word police. So the idea is to basically not to abuse this idea of the police being somehow the enemy, because the police have gone to great lengths to establish community relations with these communities.
I couldn't agree more, and I would be hard-pressed to find any police chief who would disagree with the assessment you just made. For example, in Lawrence and Chelsea, the local police chiefs have been very, very vocal about the immensely helpful implications of the sanctuary protections on the ground. The bottom line is that we need policies to make sure that everyone in our community feels comfortable interfacing with law enforcement, not just victims of crime, but also witnesses of crime. If I am walking down the street and I get assaulted and the only witness to that incident is an undocumented immigrant, do you think that that immigrant is going to feel comfortable coming forward to talk about what they saw, what they heard, to collaborate with that investigation if they perceive local police to be deportation officers? It is incredibly dangerous to entangle local police with federal immigration activities. It drives people deeper into the shadows. It makes victims, including victims of domestic violence, unable to come forward. It makes all witnesses unable to come forward. You could be an affected individual and not get the police protection that you need because the police cannot get witnesses to collaborate. They are too scared to collaborate with police to help resolve crimes. And in that landscape, we are all harmed regardless of our immigration status. And that is why these policies make sense, not just in Chelsea and in Lawrence, but in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and countless other communities. And the other thing that I would say, Ian, is that in a city like Los Angeles or San Francisco, where there is, frankly, a lot of money, there are a lot of resources. Sure, budgets are always strapped, but compared to the communities that we represent, these small blue-collar towns that barely make ends meet, defunding, destabilizing them by threatening to withhold their money, by making them enforce federal immigration law instead of local priorities, it threatens the entire community. It will be incredibly harmful and destructive. It's frankly un-American.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but just in closing, we can be absolutely certain that Sessions is basically lying when he says that sanctuary communities are protecting felons.
That is not an accurate statement. It is misleading to say that the communities that we represent, other sanctuary cities around the country, are protecting and harboring felons. Nothing could be further from the truth. What the sanctuary city protections do is that they protect U.S. citizens by allowing everyone in the community to come out when they see or hear something and to collaborate with police. That is what these communities are trying to do. That is what we're trying to protect. We're protecting everyone in our communities, including U.S. citizens.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Ivan Espinosa Madrigal.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ivan Espinosa Madrigal, who's Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice in Boston and a civil rights attorney suing the Trump administration on behalf of sanctuary communities. We're going to take a brief station break and be back assessing whether Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, is trying to sabotage inquiries into Trump's alleged ties to Russia.
Time to send someone away. Got my back covered. Said, how you been all that astray? Come, let's count its ups. They lead you to the maze where no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitutional Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be back.
Well, thank you, David. And since you were a counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee and they are doing an investigation into possible ties between Donald Trump and Russia, or specifically the Kremlin and Putin, and the House Intelligence Committee is also doing an investigation, which seems to have imploded. So the question now to explain the bizarre behavior of the chair, Devin Nunes, could it be that he was just blowing up the investigation because his outrageous behavior of going to the White House, and then apparently went the day before he showed up to with this mysterious intelligence that he handed to Donald Trump, who's the subject of the investigation. Now it turns out that he actually was in the White House the day before, so it looks as if the White House gave him this so-called intelligence, which he then handed back to Trump the following day. So is he trying to blow up the whole thing, or is he just, you know, he's not the brightest bulb, is he?
Well, I don't know. There may be a method to this madness that's very Trump-like. Devin Nunes is a Trump person, and he's blown this thing up in a way that is so confusing and bizarre that you wonder if it actually creates even more distraction from the real issue, which is that the Russians wanted Donald Trump to be president, and did Donald Trump promise something to the Russians in exchange for their help? And that's what this matter is about, and Nunes has made it about some bizarre series of events where he got out of an Uber or got out of a car with aides and got into an Uber, went to, it looks like, the old executive office building where I used to work, adjacent to the White House, had some kind of a briefing, says he also was there to warn Trump, but he was also getting the briefing at the same time, so it wasn't clear what he was warning him about. It's not clear who gave him the briefing or what he was told, but it all creates a lot of, you know, intrigue and confusion, and we're not talking again about what we should be talking about, which is that the Russians may have made a deal with Trump to make Trump our president.
Well, the latest poll that's out suggests that Americans, by a 17-point margin, that's 48% to 31%, feel that the Trump administration's relationship with Russia is a legitimate issue to investigate. So, obviously, Donald Trump created the firewall with Jeff Sessions as the Attorney General, with Mike Pompeo at the CIA, with Dan Coats, another political appointee at the DNI, and Devin Nunes, who was on his transition team on the House Intelligence Committee, and on the Senate Intelligence Committee, you have Richard Burr, who was also, I believe, he was the National Security Advisor to Trump during the election. So they're all pretty partisan. So what's happening on the Senate side?
Well, on the Senate side, you have Senator Burr, you have Mark Warner as the ranking, not, to me, the most forceful, but you do have some members on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Ron Wyden, new Senator Kamala Harris from California, who I think will be tough and will be asking the right questions. But you also have, of course, a committee I served on that is, you know, interested in protecting secrecy, which is, you know, understandable sometimes. But in this case, we want to know what happened. So there, we could end up with more closed sessions. And I think we just have a situation now where things are hyper-partisan. When I worked on the committee, we actually did work in a bipartisan manner. It was, the staff was very much integrated. We sat together, we worked together, and it was actually, the process had integrity. Even David Addington, who became the sort of White House villain, Dick Cheney aide, was the Republican counsel when I worked on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and we worked together great. So it's different now. No investigation is going to be impartial. Even if you had a special committee, the Republicans would try to load it up with partisans. And if you had instead an independent commission, I think it would also be true that it would be loaded up with partisans. The idea of people searching for the truth at this point, and I would have to say particularly on the Republican side, is a platonic ideal that is faded away in a Washington where the pace is being set by a president who's a con man and has no integrity.
And, of course, the 9/11 commission, it took a year before the George W. Bush administration agreed to even have it.
Right.
So presumably the wrangling could go on forever. So what you're saying is that the only game in town then is the Senate Intelligence Committee inquiry.
I think I don't know if they will succumb to pressure to do something more. But what I think is the way that we're going to find out the truth about this is through people of integrity, probably people who leak, or from criminal prosecutors who somehow and the FBI decide that they're going to keep going forward and not let Jeff Sessions quash what's going on. If they get something, I mean, there looks like they have something on Flynn. Flynn behaved disgracefully. I don't know if it was illegal, but it looks like while he was the Trump's advisor, he was basically selling to the highest bidder services for foreign governments. And if they find something there that's illegal, you know, ultimately someone potentially flips. Whether they have Donald Trump, you know, actually making a deal with the Russians, I don't know. But there is a deal that's very clear, which Kurt Davies, my colleague, and I outlined in an article, and that is that the sanctions against Russia are killing Putin's economy, and particularly stopping the ExxonMobil deal with Russia to drill in the Arctic. And that is the deal that sanctions are stopping, and that is the deal that Trump has said. You know, he said this a number of times before and after he was elected that he was going to be looking at lifting those sanctions. Well, that's what the Russians wanted. If that's what Trump was or is planning to do, that is the outline of a corrupt deal.
So you mentioned Flynn. Of course, Flynn is in trouble because of the interception of his phone conversations with the Russian ambassador. But now we're learning that he is also took over $500,000 from the Turkish government, met with Erdogan, the sort of authoritarian leader of Turkey's brother-in-law, and plotted to kidnap Fethullah Gulen, the exiled cleric in Pennsylvania, who Erdogan blames for everything, wants the U.S. to extradite him. So apparently Flynn had meetings where they discussed kidnapping this guy and doing a rendition.
Yes. To of a permanent resident of the United States,
right.
A legal permanent resident.
Right, and apparently the plot went as far as to actually hire a bunch of ex-JSOC-type people, specialists in rendition. Whether Flynn was doing it to show off so he'd get the money or what, we don't know. But apparently the FBI knows, and the former head of the CIA, James Woolsey, said, yeah, this happened, because he says it didn't happen while I was in the meeting.
So. Right, and who had been a Trump supporter previously,
right,
until he realized how ugly the whole thing is. Flynn is a disgrace. The idea that he was national security advisor for a millisecond is an absolute stain on our country. He was selling his influence while he was a Trump advisor. And then, of course, he concealed his conversations with the Russian ambassador, claimed they were harmless afterwards, but he concealed them. Who else did that? Jeff Sessions concealed his conversation with the Russian ambassador, afterwards claimed they were harmless. Then we did the same thing with Jared. So if these conversations were just routine discussions between an incoming administration or a potential president's staff and the Russians, which would be legitimate, why do we keep finding out about them only after they get caught and only after it leaks? They're hiding something.
Well, apparently Jared Kushner is now going to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and you just mentioned that he had also contacts with the Russian ambassador. But what happened to the scheduled hearing that was supposed to take before the House Intelligence Committee, where they had Sally Yates, their former acting attorney general, who got fired, and also Brennan, the former CIA director.
John Brennan.
And also James Clapper, the former DNI.
Got shut down. I mean, the Republicans get to decide. They control the committees. They get to decide what hearings are going to be held. And that certainly would have been an interesting hearing. I don't know exactly why it didn't happen, but as a citizen of the country and someone who's concerned about the corruption of our government, and particularly the kleptocratic Trump administration, I sure would have liked to hear from those people. Of course, nothing stops them from speaking out outside of the hearing, other than, of course, their commitment not to disclose classified information.
So what do you think happened with Nunes? As I mentioned, you know, I see him as a part of the overall pattern in the Trump administration of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, of having anti-environmentalists as the head of the EPA, and in this case putting a pretty dumb guy in charge of the House Intelligence Oversight Committee. So he did, as you pointed out, he didn't, you know, he allowed the hearing at which Director Comey of the FBI certainly said some damaging things about Trump. One, that he essentially lied about Obama wiretapping him, and two, that Trump was under FBI investigation. That in itself was pretty explosive. So do you think that the conventional wisdom is that the White House was so upset with the Comey-Rogers hearings that they basically called up Nunes and said, you got to stop this?
Seems like that's what happened. And I'm actually surprised that they did ask Comey those. I mean, obviously, most of the good disclosures were under questioning by Democrats, but the Republicans didn't even have to have that hearing. Comey can't tell them to hold a hearing. And maybe they were concerned that he would get restive and somehow his story would come out some other way. But, I mean, the whole thing proved the president was a liar. And they go back and say, well, wiretap was in quotes, but they said it was in Trump Tower. And there's no evidence of that. And if you know, what Nunes said happened, how he said he obtained the information is sketchy, and what he said happened is sketchy, but it was something about incidental collection of Trump or top aides' conversations. But that makes sense, too, because it turns out, I mean, we know the NSA and other intelligence agencies do listen in on the conversations of foreign officials. That's one. And two, we know that the Trump people were talking with people from other countries, most notably Russia. So it stands to reason that there would be collection of such information. That doesn't mean that Obama ordered it, which is what Trump said, or that it was a wiretap, which is what Trump said, or that it was in Trump Tower. So nothing that Nunes said did anything to indicate that Trump's story in any way was based on fact. It was just based on him having a fit and listening to some right-wing media. And everything he's done, you know, with this account, how it happened just shows it was sketchy. He was brought there to the White House, probably to just look on someone's computer in the old executive office building and see some information that person was working for Trump, and then come out and supposedly warn Trump. But, you know, the thing was engineered by Trump people. It's a silly, pathetic chapter, one more in this, you know, 60 days is enough of this incompetent, bombastic, ridiculous president. And our country's, you know, fortunately has been figuring out ways to push back on these Trump lies. The judiciary is staying strong, the media is staying strong, and most importantly, citizens are staying strong. And it's going to be 4 years of hell and lost opportunities on things like climate change. And by the way, Nunes is a climate denier too. But I think that we can stop Trump from causing permanent damage to our system. I think we can.
So just in closing, David Halpern, do you think that Trump's strategy, if indeed there is one behind the peculiar behavior of Nunes, is that even though it's so ridiculous and doesn't pass the laugh test, it still works with his constituency because you have a lot of Americans, supporters of Trump, who are there in the Fox Breitbart bubble, and they are in an alternative universe?
Absolutely. And anything that fuels their fantasies that people are out to get Trump and that there's a deep state that's trying to destroy Trump absolutely fuels that. But the other thing it did was we just talked for 20 minutes about how Devin Nunes is somewhere between an incompetent and a crook. We should have been talking about you know, the fact that Russia influenced our election, that Trump was at least the passive beneficiary, if not the willing partner in it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Halpern.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether or not Trump can make his claim that Obamacare will explode a reality. You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Marone, who is a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, noted for his work on health policies. He is the editor of Healthcare Policy in the USA and Germany, The Politics of Healthcare Reform, and Wealthy, Healthy, and Fair, The Politics of Healthcare for a Good Society. His latest book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Marone.
Hi, Ian. It's great to be back.
Well, thank you, James. And initially, of course, President Trump blamed the Democrats for the failure of the Trump-Ryan repeal and replacement of Obamacare. But over the weekend, he tweeted out an attack on the House Freedom Caucus, as well as the Club for Growth and Heritage Action for America. And as it, by the way, Representative Ted Poe of Texas has resigned from the Freedom Caucus, basically saying it's easy to say no but hard to lead. Is there a possibility, do you think, of this ever being revived by the Republicans, or is it dead on arrival?
It looks dead on arrival. I think the Republicans, remarkably, are a spent force on health care. What we've seen exposed is the extraordinary disjunction of views within the Republican Party. And the more people look at the bill, and I'm talking about Republican intellectuals, not the liberals, but the Republican intellectuals, the more they say it was just a stinker of a bill. It was going to the great untold story about it is that this is going to transform Medicaid. Medicaid covers 70 million Americans. It is our biggest health program. And beneath all the fuss about the Obamacare health exchanges, covers 12 million as opposed to 70 million, Ryan had packed this bill with a fundamental change in the way Medicaid got done, the way Medicaid does business. It was the largest change since that program was passed in 1965. It was a fundamental pullback of federal government responsibility for health care. And moderates took a look at that and heard their governors screaming and wanted out. And the hardline conservatives, if they had looked at that, this is something for them much to be desired. This is the biggest blow against a big federal government you could imagine. And the idea that they would turn that down, or even the prospect of sending it to wily Mitch McConnell, is just pretty extraordinary. So, yes, there's lots of blame to go around. But certainly the Freedom Caucus, boy, they, to my way of thinking, they blew it. They could have had a lot of things that we're not even talking about, most significantly Medicaid reform, and they just punted. The moderates were leaving very quickly, too, as a result. And so they're not going to come back to this coalition. What we have is a Republican Party really splintering on health care before our eyes.
But had it passed, wouldn't it have eventually backfired on the Republicans? First of all, many of these Republican lawmakers are facing angry town hall meetings where the constituents are warning them against going after their health care and telling stories about how life and death decisions are about to be made by these lawmakers. And you get the impression that these lawmakers, who, of course, are on government health care, very generous benefits that they have, they're fully covered. And their constituents are angry. And sometimes you look at these Republican congressmen, you think, my God, maybe they've never even talked to people, their constituents, about what's going on. It's all to them, all ideology, like it is with Ryan, with these Ayn Rand ideas.
Yes.
I mean, so in other words, did they basically do themselves a favor by punting?
They would. It's always hard to know where, what the effect of a really lousy policy is. So the original design was to sort of let things not go into place till the year 2020, and that would give you a kind of cushion. But having said that, even the Republican intellectuals were shaking their heads at the shakiness of all this. First of all, a large tax cut for wealthy people that really gets translated into subsidies to buy insurance that are half as generous as the Obamacare subsidies. And you can just imagine 12 million people across the country, many of them Trump's constituents, suddenly discovering that they've been cut in half, and hearing from liberals, because you can be sure they would hear this, hearing from liberals that all that went to pay for a tax cut for the high-end premium payers on this legislation. It was just a crazy kind of bill to put together, cutting the subsidies of moderate income people to protect wealthy people from a tax they're not particularly complaining about. So yes, the Republicans may have saved themselves from disaster. Those town hall meetings sort of gotten very loud. But what does this say now for Democrats and Republicans running, that we Republicans had a idea that we've banged on for 7 years and, oh, never mind, we can't agree about how to go about it? It's a great opening for Democrats here. So Republicans may be glad it didn't go into effect. Democrats have to be very happy that they are now serving for the first time, really, since 2009 on health care.
Now, it's taken a while, and I never understood why Paul Ryan had this reputation as being a policy wonk and something of an intellectual, when he's clearly just a very rigid ideologue with sort of wackadoodle libertarian ideas, and he's totally in the pocket of big money like the Koch brothers. But, you know, had he had been able to eviscerate Medicare, which is really what he boasted about it on the Hugh Hewitt show, that finally we've killed a government program. So there's no mystery about his motives. And as you pointed out earlier, it was all about killing Medicare. But I fault the Democrats, and particularly the Obama administration, for not making it clear to the American people that Medicaid is not a program solely for the poor, that just about everybody, poor, working class, middle class, and even wealthy professionals, rely on Medicaid for the home care for the elderly, which it subsidizes. So everybody has an elderly relative that's sooner or later going to go into nursing homes. So do you see that as a major failure?
Major failure. So 2 points here. First, your point about Paul Ryan, that he had this reputation as a hardworking policy wonk who understand the nuances, that just blew up. So there were a few liberals out there in the wilderness, perhaps you were one of them, Ian, who was saying, wait, this emperor has no clothes. That has now been revealed for all to see. He is getting blasted left, right, and center. Secondly, you make a very important point about Medicaid. Medicaid started in 1965 as an add-on to Medicare for poor people. It was part of the welfare system. But what's happened over time is it's been added on to and added on to. So the Medicaid program, no one expected this, but because of a little discussed benefit, long-term care, it made the American nursing home industry. One out of $3 spent by people over 65 in nursing homes is spent by Medicaid. You can't mess around with that. That's what an awful lot of American people over 65 are relying on. Then they added on benefits for children. Even Texas, stingy Texas, which has a very low bar. If you make 30% of poverty line, 30% of the poverty line, one-third of poverty, you're making too much for Texas Medicaid. But they're very generous to their children. Most states are. That's Medicaid. So this is a program that has morphed over time from basically a welfare program to a program that insures more Americans than any other program, public or private. You know, Bill Clinton was the first politician to recognize this. When he was running, he talked about Medicaid so often, and he talked about it as now the program that takes care of your parents, that his staff started kidding and saying that Bill Clinton was all about E squared, M squared. E's are education and environment. M is Medicare and Medicaid. And Medicaid, Bill Clinton saw, had become a middle-class program, and it's, you don't want to mess with that. And Paul Ryan really led the Republicans into a trap when he, pursuing a sort of ideological agenda, tried to push that through along with the repeal of Obamacare. Big mistake, in my view.
So given that Trump has walked away from the Ryan Trump repeal and replacement of Obamacare, and he's initially blamed, as I mentioned, initially blamed the Democrats who he didn't even consult, and then now is blaming the Club for Growth and the Freedom Caucus and the Heritage Foundation. So it looks like he's walked away and is going to move on to tax reform. But that doesn't mean that Trump doesn't have the ability to sabotage Obamacare, which is now, as Paul Ryan pointed out, is the law of the land. What can he do to sabotage Obamacare to fulfill his idea? And, you know, this guy operates on the craziest of notions, most of which are complete conspiracy theories. But in this case, he's basically saying it's going to explode. So is he going to make it explode?
He can. This is not a machine that runs by itself. You've got to constantly make adjustments. And remember, Obamacare also is the Medicaid expansion, and that is now left alone. But in terms of the marketplaces, there are an awful lot of constant regulations you need to do. The thing to remember about these marketplaces is the individual market. If you are just an individual shopping for health care, not part of a group, as I'm sure your employers offer you good health insurance, my university offers me good health insurance, but an individual searching for it, that market had collapsed. The Obama idea, and it's a Republican idea, is to rebuild the market. Instead of just giving it to government and saying, all right, that market's collapsed, let's let government do it, they tried to rebuild a market that the private market didn't really want. So it had to have an awful lot of sweeteners, inducements, regulations to create a market where none naturally existed. Now, to do that over time, you have to constantly make adjustments. Are the insurers making enough money? Are they cutting corners? It is like a chess match between people overseeing the plan and the insurance companies, who of course are in the business of making money. That's what the far right hated about the plan. But if you just decide, well, we're just going to let this thing run down, we're not going to make adjustments, you would create a self-fulfilling prophecy. But then you have the huge problem of, wait, now 50 million uninsured people again. That happened on my watch. Now what do I do? So Trump, who knows what, as you said, he has crazy ideas that he operates under. And he and his Secretary of Health and Human Services, Price, could easily undermine the marketplaces because it takes attention. They have to actively help to keep these going over time. But if they do that, then they've really bought themselves a problem, which is 50 million people, 40 million people without health insurance, and a heck of a good issue for the Democrats.
So, James Marone, then there's an interesting piece by Paul Krugman in the Monday's New York Times where he's talking about the issues that we're talking about, how to build on Obamacare. And while he has good suggestions of how you can build on Obamacare, and the framework is there to actually make it work, it's also, as he points out, easy to sabotage, and that's the likelier scenario with Donald Trump. But just to touch on a couple of things in terms of the optimistic side, there's also, as a result of this collapse of Ryan Care, Trump Care, a lot of people now, including Bernie Sanders, of course, are talking about going back to the public option or single payer in Bernie Sanders' case. Public option has come up as a possible way to both give competition within the insurance market. But the real issue, from what I understand, is that in the rural states, who the red states, whose legislators are dead against Obamacare, they're the ones that could most benefit from an expansion of Obamacare and particularly the public option.
It's absolutely true. And don't forget, again, that they could most benefit from the Medicaid program that they are resisting. Medicaid's so complicated, but the bottom line about that part of it is that every state gets to set eligibility. If you're in Arkansas, it's 23%. That's not a typo. 23% of the poverty line, and that anything above that, and you're not eligible for Medicaid. And it goes on up. I believe California is 108%, of the poverty line. What Obamacare did to Medicaid was to say, okay, everybody up to 138% of the poverty line, that is, for a family of four, about $33,000 a year, everybody is eligible for Medicaid if you've got the income status. The problem, the Supreme Court said they couldn't force this on the states, even though they were paying 90 cents on the dollar. And so the states, as you said, in the red rural states, which most oppose government programs and hated Obama, refused to expand their Medicaid program. And that means there's lots of poor people, some well below the poverty line, most well below the poverty line, who are not getting health care insurance through Medicaid and, of course, can't afford it and aren't even eligible for the exchanges, can't afford the exchanges. So this is an obvious gap, and I think the first thing the Democrats would want to do is say, let's get in there and see if we can cover all the poor and then worry about the middle class through the public option. But the underlying point is clear. Democrats, after they're through celebrating, put down the champagne, they need to come up with a strong proposal. It's not one that's going to pass this year, but they need to identify a health care alternative. The Republicans have just got egg all over their face. If Democrats don't come up with something, we'll just have more of the same gridlock. They need to sell their plan now in the hopes of coming back to power. It'll help them come back to power, but they need a plan, and the public option is a nice compromise between single payer and the sort of building blocks of Obama. And my guess is they'll coalesce around that with a left flank pushing for even more. But it's really important now. The ball is in the Democrats' court, and they need to come up with a simple alternative that they can explain, as you alluded to earlier, Ian, that was Obama's huge failure. His malpractice was not explaining what he was about in simple terms. Now the Democrats get a do-over. They need a plan that they can wave like a flag.
But if, for example, you were able to explain to the American people the logic of what Bernie Sanders is talking about, which is just expanding on Medicare and making Medicare for all, which is a single-payer program. You know, single-payer doesn't tell you anything. You know, it's like branding.
Yeah.
It's really poor branding. But if...
Oh, is it ever? I could interrupt for a second. That is in the Hall of Fame of stupid branding names.
Right. Well, but what I was going to say was, though, that, you know, if you explain to the average person out there that the insurance companies are the worst people to be in healthcare because they don't bring anything to the table, that you end up having to pay extra for the overhead. It's like paying for the mafia to protect you. And sometimes the extortion is worse than the protection. And in this case, they're an unnecessary layer between the caregiver and the patient. And the point of single payer or Medicare for all is that you already start out with the big pool, which is what you need. The big pool meaning that the people, the young people who don't need health care quite yet, pay in for the older people, and under the understanding that later on they'll get covered as well.
Yes. Just a quick bit of history. Single payer was on Harry Truman's mind when he first suggested it. There was so much opposition that he thought, well, let's just try it for the elderly to show it'll work. And he's the one who came up with Medicare, which was single payer for over people 65. I think it's been shown now that it works. Truman's plan was once people thought that saw that the government could do a good job, that it would then expand to the rest of the population. Republicans put a huge tax incentive, it really was solidified in the 1950s under Dwight Eisenhower, to develop these private employment plans. But we spend, Ian, $140 billion a year to give tax incentives for corporations to insure their people through the private sector. That's $140 billion we're spending, even on top of what you just said about insurance companies needing to make a profit, because after all, they're in the business of making a profit. So we are spending a huge amount of money to be able to say we don't have government health insurance. Now, people hate to talk about what's going on in other countries, and as soon as you start talking about it, they tell you about their aunt in Sweden who just has her teeth falling out because of the terrible Swedish healthcare system. But the one thing we learn looking across health systems, as you just implied in your question, is that the one thing that works to reduce costs and at the same time expand coverage is having everybody in one big pool. Monitored, I know this doesn't sound like an American thing to say, monitored by a government. The Canadians and the Americans had exactly the same experience. If you look at the health line between World War II and 1971, when they went to their Medicare National Health Insurance Program, the lines crossed seven times. So we had exactly the same inflation record. Canadians went to national health insurance and boom, what is it, 6% difference. We spent 6 cents out of every dollar to say we don't have the Canadian system. 5.5 cents, I think it is. So absolutely, when you look at either international experience, our own historical experience, Medicare, what pops into your head is, well, why aren't we doing this? And the answer is, just get your head around this. The legislative process is designed to make sure you can't do it. So imagine a program that goes to the Congressional Budget Office that says essentially, look, this is efficient. It'll get everybody health care. It'll end our health care cost spiral. It will also double the federal budget. You know that $3 trillion budget? It's going to be $6 trillion. Now, if we could get there, I agree it would be a great kind of program. The problem is every mile you get closer to Washington, the more unrealistic you look. It looks so. Sort of people talking in New York or New Jersey or California. Of course, that makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't fit the logic of our congressional process. That if you have to, by the rules, go and say, "Will this increase the deficit?" And you know what will it cost? You are asking about a program, and again, there's lots of reason to believe in it, but a program that would roughly double, would run much of the healthcare system through the federal budget, and that's a really big gulp. The other way to put it is Democrats need about 65 senators and about a 100-person majority in the House. So you're talking about a really big blue wave before it could happen. If it were to happen, and I'm saying it's almost impossible politically, my guess is, like Medicare, it would prove incredibly popular.
Well, James Marone, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with James Marone, who's a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, noted for his work on health policies. He is the editor of Healthcare Policy in the USA and Germany, The Politics of Healthcare Reform, and Wealthy, Healthy and Fair, The Politics of Healthcare for a Good Society. And his latest book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, scroll down to the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.